event, which is incorporating the village coming together, all community members and the property owners, with the proposal of a historic district being eligible and proposed, but it comes down to each property owner. It's an 18-month project, and there'll be various stops and ways along the process. And eventually, there'll be a public hearing that will be held by the village of Philmont, where the community and property owners will decide whether a historic district is in the making or not in the making. So it's in your hands. It's not in the hands of DB Inc. It's not in the hands of the village of Philmont. It is in the hands of property owners. And that also includes renters, because if you're in a rental, you can then be part of this, because your landlord would have a property included in the historic district that then could apply for assistance to help with renovations. So it's not just a property owner deal. We want the whole community, because we have a very high percentage, as you all know, of renters. So this is one of the first events. We're delighted to invite Matt Kester back again, Milestone Heritage Consulting. Matt came and did a wonderful presentation in 2017, and that was part of creating the Brownfield Area Opportunity Plan, of which creating a historic district is one of the recommendations and goals and objectives of the BOA. So we're doing a multitude of things here. We're achieving or, you know, attempting to follow one of the recommendations of the BOA. And I hope, two other quick things. I hope you'll, you know, many of you may have houses in the village. Anything yellow on this is included in the historic district. 426 properties were surveyed by Jesse Ravitch, and that's the book that you're more than welcome to buy. If you can't buy it or you don't want to buy it, there are three copies, three volumes, and they sit at the village office, and Toby has them too, and the library has, you've got the three volumes, and you also have copies to buy. And the village of Philmont office also had copies to buy. This, I'm sure that many of you are beginning to recognize this flyer. It is coming every quarter in your water bill, right? And it's very nice. It goes out in an insert. It doesn't cost the village any money, extra money to send it. And each quarter is an update of, you know, where it's going, what, how's it doing. So please don't just put this in the trash when your water bill arrives. Pay your water bill, open this. And then today, if after the presentation, and if any of you want to join the Heritage Working Group, there are a number of these flyers on the table. All you have to do is fill it out, give it into the village clerk, or you can give it to me and I'll give it to her. And so the Heritage Working Group right now has 15 members on it. Karen Dabala is here, Sean Jennings is here. Who else from the working? Oh, sorry, Toby. Toby's not only on it, but she's also a partner. Sarah Barton King and Arthur.
Hi.
And Arthur King is also a member. So there are 15. Oh, and we have over there Jennifer, who's just joined. Oh, and we have Paul and his wife, Cara. So we've got a number of the Heritage Working Group members here helping, which is great. Which is awesome. So it's open to anybody who wants to apply. It's not a closed shop. It's not a private little group, because it's been called recently. And we're just at the beginning. We've got about 18 months. The goal of the Heritage Working Group is we need to end up, ideally, with two people on every single street in Philmont that are part of the Heritage Group, because when we get to the end and the nomination has been submitted to the state, bring me in,
State Historic Preservation Office.
Office.
SHPO.
They then, well, SHPO, yes.
In New York, it's the OPRHP.
Exactly.
Alphabet soup.
Yes, alphabet soup. And then what happens is they accept the nomination, but then they get in contact with every single property owner. And they send out a letter. And they say, we have on our panel, we are going to be adjudicating whether or not this village wants to pursue a nomination. And if they don't hear from you, if you don't make a response, it's over. There's no other time you can apply. It's not like, okay, you fail, and now you can do it all again. It's a one-shot deal. So the idea of the working group, Heritage Working Group, is that we end up with literally two people, three people, like Main Street would be eight people. So that when it's that those letters go out, they can be talking to their immediate neighbours and say, did you get it? Have you met a response? Right? And then we will deal with all of the people who own properties outside of the village, and we'll be making phone calls, because you know there's a considerable amount of people that aren't circulating in the village. They don't actually live here, but they have properties. So the working group, PB Inc., will be hands-on doing robocalls at that time. That's about 18 months from now. So with that, I'm going to thank you once again, Matt. I'm going to let you introduce your... Okay. I did have it, and I thought, I think it's always better when the person who's doing it actually introduces.
Sure.
Even though I printed it from your website.
Sure, thank you.
All right.
While I'm thinking of it, you mentioned property owner agreement or objection. So 50% of the individual property owners, not necessarily rental or renters, they would have a stake,
yes,
but not a say,
yes,
in the National Register. So 50% or more of the property owners have to give it the thumbs up for it to go through.
We're saying 70.
Well,
we've raised it.
Well, that may be your own bar.
That's our bar.
You're shooting high. That's your own aspiration. But from a technical standpoint,
50.
You know, across the board, nationally, as far as the program is concerned, 50% of the property owners have to approve.
And then it's the renters. We want the renters to be involved in the effort, because it's the renters who can then say to their landlords, write and say, we know this is coming up. We really want you to do this. Mm. Right? So they can, you know, be really tragic not to see renters.
Well, rental properties as income-producing properties
would
be eligible for tax credits for rehabilitation, which we'll talk about, because income-producing properties that are listed in the National Register are eligible for those. So that's why I said they would be potential stakeholders or benefactors, but not technically they are not the voters.
They're not
on the
voters,
50%.
But it would, you know, we have 65% of the population here are renters, so we do not want to exclude the input and the energy and the support of renters. And it would, you know, that's a clear cut down, you know, the middle of the village, so not a good idea, right?
I'm sorry, can you clarify the 50%, please? Because I just got confused by what both of you just said. So, is it 50% of...
You have to have a letter will go out from the State Historic Preservation Office saying your village is under consideration as a National Register Historic District, and maybe there'll be some other information along with it that explains what that is and isn't. Always important, and we'll touch on that. And there has to be 50% buy-in or agreement by the property owners that will say, I'm delighted, I want my property to be part of the Historic District. Or, no, I don't want that. So you need to have 50% or 51. I mean, you need to have a majority of people. I guess that would be 51%, technically. You have to have half or more, you know, buy in and agree to be listed, or else the whole thing, you know, it can't be approved. You can't force people to be listed, unless they're in a minority.
You made a statement that suggested that the property owner also had to live here, that you're making these calls to property owners who don't live here.
No, they're just
property owners. They can be absentee. They don't have to live here.
Okay, thank you.
How is that, is it one property, one vote, or is there any kind of...
Yes. If you have 62 people living in your house, it's one vote, if you're the owner.
But what if you own two properties?
Well, if you own two properties, good question. I don't know. Let's do the Q&A after.
Okay.
So I'm Matt Kerstead. I am a historian. My focus is industry and engineering and transportation and those kinds of resources, but you're a mill town, so I think it's a great place. So I do some preservation planning, public history interpretation, mitigation documentation. So I don't always save things. Sometimes the things I work on go away, but at least they're documented. So that's what I do professionally. I was here, yes, it was what, 2017?
2017.
5 years ago. How many people saw me speak then? Not too many. That's good. So there's a lot of new faces seeking new information. Can everyone hear me in the back?
Yes.
Hear me just fine? All right. So what I'd like to do is turn off the lights. Is that door open doorway blinding anyone, or can you see? Okay. So we need the air. So, you want to do a National Register Historic District. So, I've introduced myself.
You might be holding it upside down because I just saw a laser flash towards your hand.
You also might want to be pointing it at the projector.
Thank you.
We
put a man on the moon in 1969. So. All right, now it is not advancing. And I am pointing it. The laser pointer works. So the battery isn't dead.
Do you want me to sit and do the forward arrow?
It can work. Matt likes to move around.
What a bummer. It was working a few minutes ago.
It will. Marty, can you do that time? It was working
earlier. It was. This is the business end of it here, the narrow end. And the laser pointer is working. So the... Isn't this exciting?
Yay.
Okay, so
let's get you back.
So do you, I have it as a PDF and a PowerPoint. Does that make a difference or?
No, it's fine. I'm just wanting to get you back to your first slide.
You're spoiling all of the surprises.
I know.
Yeah, you saved it.
So is this, do you know what slide number?
No, it's just somewhere in the middle here. So can we go back to the beginning?
Well, that's yeah. I'm trying to do it without
the two there. It looks like it all of a sudden all but went
once. All right.
You're all good?
Yes.
Yes.
Ready?
All right.
So, it's all about the landforms. They came here first, the geology. So, right there in the middle of the map, this is mountain ranges in the northeast. Right there in the middle of the map, the T, that's the tectonics. So, we're on the west side of them, and all the water's rushing off them, and there are also fault lines, the tectonic and other faults that run up and down here. So, all this water coming off the mountains and flowing towards the Hudson falls in cataracts and precipitously in many communities between the tectonics and the river. And so where the water falls, it generates power, and you can create mill privileges. And the word privilege is such because kings granted people the rights to mill on certain falls. They were was a privilege that was granted. I think it's an interesting etymology of the word. This is your pond and your dam here in Philmont. And so with the tremendous drop that you have over the falls, there was great potential to dam and create industrial water power, or HEAD. So in the late 1700s, a lot of small mills sprang up, self-sufficiency. You could add full, yes, grist saw and fulling. So food, clothing, and shelter, right? And so it's all self-sufficiency. But we've just so much water power here that there's a lot of it. So after 1800, we have the Napoleonic Wars, trade embargoes, all kinds of things that were arriving on the East Coast docks on boats. It's not happening anymore. So we need to start making our own wool and cotton and other things. So there's an efflorescence of larger wooden and stone mills being built on these falls. And so Columbia County, with all of the waterfalls, gets a lot of the mills and a lot of the action. Then there's the Merino sheep craze, and everybody's knitting and weaving and knitting wool. So by the mid 1800s, you've got all these beautiful mills, in and so few of them are left. So here we've got Stockport, Galicia, Stottville. You know, I could name a half a dozen other places. The only mills that survive of these four are the ones in the upper right at Stuyvesant Falls. And knitting came in big, starting in Cohoes, and it spread all over. So this is hosiery, socks, long underwear, and tubular things as opposed to woven sheet. So George Philip was a very early miller, and although this site is technically right over the town line, these histories and contexts know no political boundaries, which may not even have existed at the time. So I'm including this because it's reputedly a site of a first, if not the first, textile mill, textile-related mill here. There were some claims made by Peter Stott in his book about Columbia County industry, which seem to have been revised through the research that was done in the National Register nomination. But history is always being revised.
What is a fulling mill?
A fulling mill? Mm-hmm. Fulling is pounding and treating fabric to manipulate its structure, so that you are softening it, and for instance, if you're making wool hats, you know, you need to take the fibers and flatten them, straighten them, you know. So it's a process of altering the character of the fibers of textile, particularly wool. Everyone's heard of saw and grist, no one's heard of fulling. It's like the third leg of the stool for, as I said, food, clothing, shelter. And so this is a couple of shots of the backside of this site, some of the industrial archaeological mill ruins along the creek. So transportation is important. You've got to ship the stuff to market. So some very early and strategic railroads came to Philmont that connected it with the Boston and Albany Railroad, linking those cities. Also to the Hudson River and south to New York City. So you had markets for goods, and people who wanted to work could get here. So in 1845, George Philip looks at this water system with this tremendous waterfall and the adjacent land, and develops a water power system, a series of canals, trenches, holding ponds, and creates a number of locations adjacent to the falls where the water can be diverted and sent through the water wheels and later turbines of a chain of mills that were erected down the mountain, down the hillside. And so the series of names Place names evolve out of that industrial utilization and landscape, and the water had to be controlled, so there was water rights and usage agreements and flow regulation, and all of the mill owners were talking to one another every day about whether it was going to rain and who needed so much water, and they all made this work. One mill's tailwater was the next mill's headwater.
So that was 1945.
Well, I'm discussing typical mid-19th century trends as they apply to Philmont. But yeah, these are in the years prior to the Civil War. So yes, Philip initiated this process in 1845. And then a sixth mill was built at the bottom before the water returned back into the creek. And Civil War, you know, uniforms, underwear, lots of guys need clothes. Mm-hmm. So this was a really boom years for northeastern textile manufacturers supplying fabric for the Union Army. So in 1873, after the Civil War, you've got two-thirds of Claverack's population is here in Philmont. And the community incorporated in 1892, and you had the largest workforce of any Columbia County town here, about 1,000 people working in the mills. And it was a company town, so pretty much your living arrangements, how you spent your spare time, where you went to church, what you bought in the store, and how you paid for it was all dictated by the mill. In return, they built schools, and helped with churches, and built housing and parks and those kinds of things, keep people happy. So in 1912, there was a major industry consolidation, a typical trend at the time, and a nationally known engineering firm, Lockwood and Green, I think they were out of Boston, came and built a new mill complex. Mill number two, again, superlatives associated with the employment here. So these companies paid taxes, so it's a boom town. Boom and bust. The 1930s, depression hits all northeastern industry, and these communities that have these textile milling mono economies are particularly hard hit. And the last mill closes in 1963. So where I'm from in New England, Blackstone Valley, Rhode Island, same stories. It takes a very long time. Sometimes the communities are still dealing with it, to recover from the economic aftermath of the loss of an industry that was this powerful and pervasive. So if you want to learn more about this stuff, I recommend this fantastic book by my friend and colleague, Peter Scott. This book is very hard to find now. But I'm sure your library has a copy, Columbia County Historical Society too. Great book, tremendous detail. More than I can give you today. Yes.
Is he any relation to Stokesville?
Mm. Yes. So here's the 1881 aerial perspective engraving from the from one of the county atlases, and there's all this kind of dense hash of mills and houses here. So 4 years of art school paying off again. I got my colored pencils out and colored this in for you so that you can see the red, red mills and the blue, blue water. And so here's your big pond, hits this first mill, there's a dam here, comes down, there's another dam, the water is diverted to a holding pond behind this mill, then it runs over here, this is right downtown, more or less opposite the CVS or whatever it is there. Then the water flowed under the street to this mill. Here are the row houses that have those little tin sheds behind them.
part of this mill, or maybe that one, I don't know, is still there. Then there was another big holding pond. I think this may be where there's a playing field or something. I can't remember. Then the water went under the road and powered this last mill and flowed back into the creek. So, like I said, one mill's tailwater is the next mill's headwater. So you can see there would have to be a lot of coordination and cooperation about how this water is flowing. So much of these buildings have been lost, but also the evidence of the water courses, which were open, that ran through the middle of town. And so this view is what we were just looking at, top to bottom. This is going from right to left. So this is the Sanborn Fire Insurance map. I think I might have cut and pasted several of them together. Mm-hmm. And so there's some, maybe some gaps or chunks missing. But this shows you again in plan view what we just saw in an isometric or an oblique. This is always a fun exercise when I'm trying to get my arms around a new mill town to get the fire insurance maps and make one of these little strip maps. So this is a great postcard view. And again, mimicking more or less from right back to left what we were just looking at in plan view. And another kind of close-up of the three of the biggest mills. So this is the one up here that's still standing, I believe. That's gone, that's gone. And some of these houses are still there. I'm sure you recognize those.
Where is that?
That's Prospect.
Okay. Yeah.
So some of the industrial archaeological remains and architectural as well, standing mill buildings, but if you go out behind them, you can see the remains of some of the flumes. The turbine for this mill is, I believe, was inside this case. Storehouses for, I believe, mill number 3. And then this is really impressive. These raceways, these were hewn right out of this soft slate rock. So you can imagine laborers beating on the rock with hammers and pickaxes to excavate these trenches to let the water flow through. You see these every once in a while. They're always very compelling. And you all know about the dam and the gorge and all that. So this is the second mill privilege or pond on the creek. And yeah, this is the Summit Mill. That's the one at the top, powered by the first dam, the one that survives. Really remarkable. You're so lucky to have this surviving mill building. It's kind of quintessential with its stair tower and brickwork. So here's some more of that awful PowerPoint stuff where he stands there and reads the words. And I don't usually do that, but for some reason there's a bunch of those in this this presentation. I think one of the neat things about the about this and many other mills is the stair tower. Why is it outside of the building? Well, because it's a chimney. So if there's a fire in the building, you don't want the fire racing up the stairs if they're inside the building. So they had big, heavy, metal-clad fire doors that would slide shut in the event of a fire and shut the tower off the stairwell from the rest of the building to try to control the draft. The toilets were often in an outside-engaged tower, so when you see a tower on a mill, it's not always the stairwell. And if it projects a story or two above the mill, it often had a gravity-fed water tank in there for the sprinkler system.
How many people were employed?
In that particular mill?
Yeah.
Good question. I don't know. There are figures that I have here for overall employment in the town at a couple of periods, but it may be that Peter Stott goes into that kind of granular detail in his book. He may well.
So they were coming from other towns, so they all lived around here.
I would think that Before the automobile, they all lived here, and they walked to work. Once you get the automobile, that frees people up a little bit, and they can live on the outskirts and drive to work if they can afford to have a car.
So that was in the 1900s.
There were trains.
1900s, 1910s?
For what? Automobiles?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably wouldn't be until at least maybe the 20s, until the common guy had a Model A or something.
So
but,
that was during the wars, the war, right?
Well, again, some of the constructs that I'm discussing are things that are industry-wide.
Okay.
Yep, there were trains here as well.
Yeah, and I mentioned that we had the trains. The Harlem Division came right through. We'll touch on that in a moment. So Peter Stock says, the Summit Knitting Mill is today one of the best preserved textile mills in Columbia County. Not that there are too many survivors, but it sure is one of them. So we had two railroads here in town. The big one, the New York Central Harlem Division, ran up high on the hill. And then it was a branch line that went where on the river? Red Hook, Rhinebeck, something, Tivoli, I can't remember. It was a spaghetti bowl of railroads around here at one time. So this is the surviving station here on the lower left. And this is a super rare surviving railroad building. It's a freight house. For every 100 depots that survive, you know, there's a handful of freight houses that do. So you're really lucky to have to still have that.
And where's the freight house?
This is the train station down by Cross,
right.
And the freight house is diagonally up the line. So if you take a right here and go to the end and double back and cross over, like you're coming this way, I don't know the street names. It's right there in a field on the left-hand side.
And it's still there, it's still standing.
Yes.
It's right after what?
Yeah, it's a remarkable survivor. So, we've dealt with the industry, the water power infrastructure, the mills, the transportation. So, what about the rest of it? So this is your historic district. This is your National Register district coming into the discussion here. You had a vibrant Main Street with the multi-story commercial buildings. A lot of that fabric survives. There's teeth missing in the face of the street, but there's integrity here. There's still some great old buildings. There's a really remarkable variety of different kinds of worker housing. Sometimes only one or two examples of it, but lots of different kinds. Sometimes you go into these towns and there's only hundreds of one kind. That one up there actually was a very, very early mill that was converted into a triplex. Here are some attached brick row houses.
That's the one that burned. That's the one that burned. It burned just a couple of years.
Here's some of my slides might be outdated. I did come back in June and take new ones. This is still there. And another remarkable survivor, these ephemeral little sheds here, these things go away, everywhere. And yet you have, and the fence comes to the middle of the wall, and the structure is shared by the two adjacent yards. Half a dozen of them. I was stunned when I saw these. It's a really interesting surviving industrial texture. Again, you're lucky to have these. Those are the houses that I pointed out on that aerial view and the Sanborn map. And this is interesting. It's kind of grand. But it's a duplex. So you have not just the housing for the mill operatives, the mill workers, but you have a range of housing for lower and middle and upper level management before you get to the mansion on the hill that was owned, the mill owner's house. So these kinds of duplexes might be a couple of middle level management people working in the mill. And then the fine homes. Maybe they are mill owners, but you also had every one of these towns had the lawyer and the doctor and these other people who were making money off of the community and
they had grand homes as well. I think I got three of the four surviving churches in the year. Usually built by congregations, but sometimes with assistance from the mills. I think these before and after pictures are always fun. That's the building next door.
The origin of the name Hopkins House?
No, I don't. These hotels changed hands often, and I've seen postcards here where this Empire House has a couple of other names. So I think the ownership would change pretty rapidly. So here we were talking about the railroads, and here is the Upper Railroad, the New York Central Harlem Division. Stopping right next to this. So across the street is the bus yard.
Raywood Avenue.
So what are the opportunities that we have here? We're going to talk about the National Register nomination, certainly, and what the benefits are of that. But there are crazy people like me who industrial heritage tourism. And this is some hydro plant upstate in Cohoes. But I think that there's a lot of potential here, particularly with recreational assets like the rail trail coming, to really make this obviously a place for you because you live here, but to make it an attractive and interesting place for tourism because they spend money, right? And also trails. I think that this is in Philmont, but this is in Newburgh on Quassayet Creek, but I think that there are also opportunities out there in the woods. You know, a lot of the pictures that I've showed you, some of it's private property. But, you know, through time and conversations and agreements, you know, you can start to bring these properties into the public ownership and start to create some interesting nature and industrial heritage trails with opportunities for interpretation, trail side interpretation. And then there's the rail trail. So they're in Hillsdale now and moving north, and there are some barriers, but it's going to get here eventually. I'm working on new interpretive signage for them. This is an example of, it doesn't look so good against the black background because it has a black border, but they insisted on keeping their oval interpretive panels, which they've had for about 15 years. So I figured, well, the New York Central's logo is oval, so let's work with that. So this takes into some of the design elements from various New York Central Railroad logos. So you should start to see these sprouting up along the trail in the next year or so. So there's the history. So now here we are, National Register nomination, not National Register District, the preservation planning aspect of all of this. So National Register Historic Places listing gives you a National Register Historic District. And there are pros and cons and other benefits. We'll touch on those. But I think the most important and applicable one is rehabilitation tax credits. And we'll talk more about what that is. So last year, Jesse Ravitch completed what I think is just an amazing survey. And the level of detail, the deed research that she did, if you haven't read it and you really want to get your arms around the history, it's really, really great. So I highly recommend that you pursue trying to saw through that. So this is the first step in the process, is to do a survey, reconnaissance level survey. What's out there? What's old? What isn't? What's good? What's not? Establish the historical themes and contexts. Come up with a list of properties that are potentially eligible for the National Register based on their history and their physical integrity. What kind of shape are they in? And then, is there a there? You know, can we
carve a district? Is there a boundary? And so that's what Jesse did and brought you up to the point where you know what you got, and then you can start to make some intelligent decisions about it. So the yellow properties, there's a couple of other colors in there which are probably different uses, but everything within the purple line. Is Philmont's color purple? I see purple in the P on the floor here, so I don't know if that's your high school football team is purple, but that's what Jesse chose for the boundary. And Sally has 11 by 17 printouts of this map. So what were Jesse's conclusions? The village of Philmont is a remarkably intact example of an upland industrial village in the Taconic region of New York. The Philmont Historic District is eligible for listing in the National Register of Historic Places under National Register criteria A and C. There are four criteria, A, B, C, and D. NR criterion A, association with events that have made a significant contribution to the broad patterns of our history. The district is eligible under A in the area of industry for its association with the growth and expansion of textile mills powered by Agawamic Creek. Under criterion C, those are for resources that embody the distinctive characteristics of a type, period, or method of construction, or that represent the work of a master, or that possess high artistic values. Here we are, that represent a significant and distinguishable entity whose components may lack individual distinction. So you have buildings here, you know, but maybe this church or Summit Mill or this house that would be, there's historically significant enough and they maintain enough physical integrity that they could well be individually eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. However, you've got so many good examples of things like that here, plus some that are under it in terms of their significant, their representative examples, or they're in not so great shape, but you can still tell what they are. You could bring it back, you know? So if you've got a critical mass of those kinds of things, then you've got a historic district. So that's what that aspect of criterion speaks to. It's that sum of the parts of the, you know, that thing. So that's what you have here. So the district is eligible under C in the area of architecture as a representative example of an older mill hamlet that rapidly expanded into a factory building. So those criteria are the agreed upon, defensible criteria around which one examines and makes a determination about a historical property or properties. The National Register Program is administered by the National Park Service. And at the state level, by the State Historic Preservation Office, which in New York is the Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation. So what is National Register listing? What is it not? It's an honor. This property meets these accepted criteria of historical significance and integrity to join an official list of significant U.S. historic resources. This fosters pride of place and helps with destination making. So the town gets a big plaque. And you can toot that. It offers some aspects of protection, and this is misunderstood. Federally funded projects, so by extension, money, federal money that would go to the state. Say they wanted to widen Main Street and make it 8 lanes wide, which they wouldn't, but let's just say, or something like that, right? So this has to go through review, and the impacts of the project have to be taken into account. Their impact to the historical resources, those impacts would have to be mitigated. And so there's a process. It becomes part of the environmental review process. And say National Grid wanted to build transmission lines right over the crossing Main Street. That's a project that rises to a high enough level in environmental review that, again, the impacts, visual or otherwise, of that project would have to be reviewed and taken into account and mitigated. So National Register listing buys you that. And then it enables these historic preservation tax credits for projects that follow the Secretary of the Interior's standards for rehabilitation. So people get confused between local historic district and National Register Historic District because two out of the four words are the same, and they're kind of the same thing, but they're not really. To me, this is one of the biggest tragedies in preservation because some people, and smart people, sometimes run away from this National Register thing because of what they don't understand the difference. So National Register, you could individually list or have your house listed in a district tomorrow. You could paint it pink with purple polka dots. You could attach, build a breezeway with an attached two-car gambrel roof garage. You could tear it down. Nobody cares. Nobody's going to stop you from doing anything. Local historic district, that's the thing you've heard about where your brother-in-law and wife moved into this new town and they had a baby and they wanted to build an addition and they couldn't, a dormer, and they wanted to paint their house a certain color and they wouldn't let them. That's the local historic district. So everybody in town has to decide they want that. It's overseen by an appointed board. There are rules and guidelines. I've served on these things. Unless you have historians and architects on them, they behave sometimes in an arbitrary and capricious manner, and they do. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the National Register Historic District. Let me go the other way here. So, am I on the right slide here? Yeah. They're all looking the same to me, sorry.
That's where you just
Okay. So it enables these tax credits. So what does that mean? It gives a tax break, and that's an annual property tax break, for owners of buildings improved according to the Secretary of the Interior standards for rehabilitation. Well, now it's sounding like you kind of do have to follow some rules. Well, yes, you do. There's a quid pro quo. You've got to follow certain guidelines in restoring your house to get the tax break. So who's eligible? Income-producing properties. So this can be a rental property. It can be a bed and breakfast, Airbnb. You've got to be income-producing. It can be commercial. Shops, Main Street stores. It can be industrial. It can be a for-profit institutional or some mixed use of the above. And there are also, this is federal and state. The federal tax credit is a certain percentage. Most states have a matching or corresponding state tax credit. And the amount, the federal is 20%. The state tax credit varies. Sometimes it's 15, sometimes it's 20. Some states have 30% for mills. And, it varies state by state. New York is one of the states that happens to have a residential homeowner tax credit. So there are certain ways of doing certain things to your house if it's not income producing. And the State Historic Preservation Office has people that can talk to you about this stuff in much greater detail. So how does it work? I process these tax credits for people. When I lived and worked in Rhode Island, we have big developers, 100,000 square foot textile mill complexes, and very complicated, but got it down to a science. Now that I've hung out my own shingle and I do some small tax credit projects, I'm doing one right now on a house that's 16 by 22 feet. It's the most difficult tax credit project I've ever done. And it's got more to do with the client than, but I won't say any more. But so it's a simple, it's as I tell my clients, your bottom line, you're entering into a contract with the Internal Revenue Service. That sounds intimidating, but it's actually really simple. So you want to get a preservation consultant, which would be somebody like me or Jesse, someone like that. You want to get a restoration architect, an architect or a builder that's familiar with the tax credit process, and a tax credit attorney and a CPA. And there are plenty of people in Buffalo, Albany, New York City, and some of the Hudson River Valley towns of Hudson who, you know, who do these things and are helping people with those legal and financial aspects. I just do the technical part, which is shuffling the paperwork, which is these applications, the 1, the 2, and the 3. So part 1 is kind of a formality. It just certifies that the project is listed in the National Register of Historic Places or that it will be by the time you get a certificate of occupancy. All of these are reviewed by the State Historic Preservation Office and then more or less rubber stamped by the National Park Service. Again, usually a formality. Application part 2, this is the really complicated part. This package has drawings, existing condition photographs, and a written narrative. It describes everything, the foundation, the masonry, the chimney, the windows, the interior floor plan, the siding, all the different elements of the structure. What they are look like now, what's historic fabric, you know, what the alterations have been, and then it lays out what you're going to do. So you follow the Secretary of the Interior Standards for Rehabilitation, which are 10 sort of philosophical guidelines, like a general roadmap. And then there are all these preservation briefs and technical bulletins that go into how all the thou shalt nots on how to, you know, you don't sandblast the brick and all that kind of detail. So there's a lot of guidance from the National Park Service and the representatives at the State Historic Preservation Office as to how you proceed. So your part 2 package just says, what do you got, what are you going to do? So that needs to be reviewed and approved as well. If there's things they don't like, they say you got to adjust A, B, and C, you submit an amendment, and then you know, you're good to go. Generally, you want to do all this before you start construction. Lots of people don't. It's a real pain. And then the part 3, when you've got the C of O and you're finished with the work, the preservation consultant goes back, takes pretty pictures from the same angles as the previous ones, and you prove that you followed your part 2. So that's your contract with the IRS. Here's how I'm going to fix up the building. Look, I did it. You get the check. If you didn't, things get complicated. So what are the things you're getting a tax break on? You're getting a property tax break on the cost of what are called the QREs, the Qualifying Rehabilitation Expenditures. So that's everything in the building that's historic. The frame, the roof, the siding, the stairs, the windows, all of that stuff. You either restore what's there or put it back in kind. This is all reviewed and approved. You know, no Anderson windows. Believe it or not, this always amazes people and it's great. All of the systems, your electricity, your plumbing, your HVAC, covered. Shoveling the snow, bushes, property manager's fee? No, none of that kind of O&M stuff is covered by the tax credit.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So that's from your property taxes, but property taxes are local taxes. What's the mechanism that brings this national certification down to local property taxes?
That's why you hire a tax credit, a CPA.
Okay.
Because they'll go into all the details of all stuff, which I intentionally avoid.
Okay.
Because I don't like to advise people on that because it gets me into trouble. I do the part 1, 2, 3, the technical preservation aspects of that. I have my hands full just with that stuff. I don't want to advise people on the finances. But it works and people are doing it. And there's a trade-off here. You could just say, no, thank you. Fix up the building, put some aluminum siding on it, knock those old brackets out from under the eaves, and call it a day. Yeah. Nobody can stop you. They can stop you in the local historic district. They can't stop you in the National Register district. But if you want to do the tax credits, you got to follow the rules. And, you know, some of this preservation stuff costs money. You got to get somebody to make you 23 of those brackets and put them back on. Right? So ideally, and this is what you work out with the accountant, am I at least going to break even, if not make a little money, by spending the money preserving the building right and getting the tax break? So that's why it gets complicated from an accounting perspective.
No, and you know, no one has a crystal ball, but there are models. Everyone's doing it. Some people just don't want to. And there's definitely a learning curve. So the first one's tough, and they get easier if you own multiple properties.
Well, what about federal taxes? Do you get any kind of income tax break on this also, tax credit for that? Against your federal income tax?
Yes.
I believe so. But I know that I think it's a property. It's a property and or income tax break.
Okay.
But you can Google this stuff. I don't pretend to be an expert on the financial aspects of this. So what did Jesse conclude? That Philmont's architectural resources might be viewed as assets. To the community at large and also to the individual property owners. Historic district documentation, that's completing the nomination, can enhance planning efforts. So getting your arms around the history at that next level is a planning tool. A National Register district would provide opportunity to local property owners to take advantage of the incentives at the state and federal levels for the rehabilitation of the listed properties, the tax credit. And the village could benefit from a historic district nomination as the community is increasingly engaged in improving many aspects of living in Philmont.
Help the tourist.
So I think we actually have a second presenter, and then we can get into the Q&A part of the symposium.
Can we interface with Carolyn?
Yeah.
We do like round questions, but
well, I think that she, it's now her opportunity to speak.
Okay.
And then we'll do round table after that.
Okay, you want to do it that way. Okay. Sorry, I wasn't paying attention. I was talking to Sarah. So my name is Karen DeBella. I am I have a real estate business right here in the village. Hi, everybody that I know. It's good to see your faces. During the Heritage Group, a lot of the group asked questions about assessments and how are the assessments going to be affected by the historic registry. So, although I am not an assessor, I don't claim to be assessor, I can give you some answers, but if you have specific questions, I will address you to the assessor. However, I have had conversations with Suzette Bowie, who is the deputy for the real estate, Columbia County Real Estate Division, and I've also had conversations with Howard Gleason, who is a 30-year veteran assessor. I've had conversations with him, and then my 20 plus years of real estate dealing with assessments. So no, your assessments will not be affected by being in a National Historic Registry. It does not work that way. Your assessments are based on market values, not historic registries and stuff like that. And no, if your value is $100,000 and you purchase a home for $250,000, chances of your assessment going from 100 to 250 is slim, except if there is a town-wide evaluation, then you're going up, doesn't matter who you are, or if the building itself shows different than what the county records show, then they're going to come in and they're going to increase your assessment as well. So, I don't know what other questions people may have on assessments, but I will hang out and answer them the best I can.
Is there a devil's advocate kind of question here, but I think it's a good one. Is there any relationship between, if you improve your property, you may be improving its resale value?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Does that matter? Does that have any bearing on your property taxes?
So that is a great question. So if you improve your property and then the next year the assessor comes through, you potentially could have an increase in assessed value. And that would be a great question for your assessor. They would be the one that would tell you. If you do new construction, of course, if you go from vacant land to now having a building on the property, yes, you are going to have a huge increase in assessment. Get ready. So, but yeah, that would be an assessor question.
Yeah.
My professional opinion would be, yeah, your value is going to go up some. Yes. Your assessment value. And then there's two values. We all know there's the assessor's full market, and then there's the assessment value on your taxes. Take a look. The taxes are based on the assessment, not the assessor's full value. Peter.
My question, I have several, but just this one. If I understand this correctly, and the building is approved with all these and it becomes registered, then you qualify for federal tax and local tax benefits.
State and federal tax credits. If it's an income-producing property or under the homeowner tax credit.
The homeowner. So take the homeowner. So that's state tax credits, but we pay our real estate tax to the county, to the school district, to the village, and the township. So that means that our taxes will be reduced that we have to pay to all those four entities?
So may I speak?
Yes.
Okay, so I had a question for you, because we all know we have tax exemptions, right? We have our STAR exemption, we have our age exemption, or veterans exemption. So my question to you was, would the National Historic Registry be another exemption to lower the assessment, which in turn would reflect a lower tax bill? But my answer to you, Peter, is that there are different exemptions. So your STAR exemption only goes after your school bill, where your aged and veterans only affect your town and county bills. So my thought is, if you're going to get any type of a reduction, it's going to be based on the town and county, not necessarily the school, but I do not have a positive answer until I speak to the assessor.
No comment.
Okay.
It's complicated. And I'm used to practicing in southern New England, where we have different government structures. There's no county government.
Okay.
And school taxes handled differently. So, I mean, these are good questions. And I think that the next step for another meeting would be to identify a tax credit attorney and CPA, people who have expertise in these areas, because I don't want to speak, because I don't want to speak out of turn. So perhaps the next step for, people are free to pursue this information, and it's out there. But maybe the next meeting, we could invite people who can, and an assessor, and speak to some of these things.
Well, I can tell you that we did outreach to the assessor, and the assessor said no, that they would not come and do an outreach, right? Because it's super complex. An assessor doesn't want to find themselves in that position. So, as I said, this is the beginning of an 18-month process. So now you have that, you know, having shown you the history, why this is important. Next, you can go on PB Inc.'s website and click on a recording that we did with Parks, where Jennifer Beckworth, who's in Parks and who's working with us, and Jesse Ravage, and she actually does address a few of the questions to do with tax credits. So we were hoping, so you know, for instance, and you can confirm this, if you know, there's a kind of mindset, you know, out there that's saying, well, if we create historic district, our taxes will go up. That's it. We've heard it. We've been on the street already, you know, with surveys. We've answered a lot of questions. And there's this kind of mindset. So the reason that we wanted to do, you know, start these outreaches was really to be able to document your questions so that we at the Heritage Group then could hear. We also have heard many times, historic district, that means I won't be able to paint my house pink.
And that's because there's a local preservation historic district in Kinderhook. And that's different
from
what
Hudson.
The only two in Columbia County. But in the, you know, lexicon of information and misinformation, and it is out there that historic districts prevent you. You could paint your house with polka dots. It's nothing to do with creating historic district. If you improve your roof, it has nothing to do with your taxes are not going to go up depending on. However, if you build a garage, your taxes are going to go up regardless whether you're in a historic district or not one. Because you've joined, right? So there are all these layers of, you know, complicated. On top of which, you know, just being recently working, PBN put the team together to develop 56 Main Street, the Hopkins House. And we pulled in the team, and we have preservation studios, and we pulled in Urban Vantage. And those two were really necessary. PB went to the Preservation League, who have been supporting, you know, we've written several grants, and luckily been, you know, awarded those grants to write the nomination, you know, the survey, and now the nomination recently, getting the top award of that. So when you get into developing a really big building like the Hopkins House or the hotel, you know, everybody knows 56 Main Street, right? It's super complex. So there is no way that your regular CPA or your, you know, I'm not going to name a company, I'm just going to say your regular, you know, person that you file your tax with, whether it's a company or an individual accountant. It's so complicated, the tax credits. You actually have to have a company that's really skilled in being able to do it so that they can talk to you. And that part 1, 2, and 3 that Matt showed you, right? That one part 1, 2, and 3. That's really important. The because the accountant who would be actually skilled in tax credit needs to know what you're planning to do, because then that informs what the tax credit would be. You see, so it's you know, lots of balls working together.
It's a team.
When you do this. It's a team.
Team effort.
It's an absolute team. And just looking, you know, coordinating grant applications on 56 Main Street relating to the overall budget, relating to the tax credits that are going to be applied there. And that building, we're doing a separate nomination, because the history, historic district won't be in play for that building to be able to take advantage of. So we've got, you know, a really big puzzle going on there. And of course all of these things work out. You can't write a grant for a certain amount of money, because you need to have this, you need to know what the tax credits are going to be, so you can start to balance that out with the grant. It's super complex. However, I don't want you to think it's so complex, because once the historic district comes in, you get free technical assistance from SHPA, from parks. It doesn't cost you any money. In fact, if you go on our website right now, you'll see at the and you have it here also at the bottom of the resource evaluation is an email to Jennifer Beckworth, I think. Yes, it is. So Jennifer Beckworth, if you have questions that you specifically want to ask about your building, Jennifer Beckworth, email her and she will provide that free technical assistance to you. So we'd like to, the next step would be able to, maybe we'll ask Urban Vantage, you know, because we need somebody to come in who's got practical experience. Or we'd even use 56 Main Street that we all know and love, and use it as an example to show you how this works.
Well, I think you need to get some reps who either, you know, individual practitioners or some firms do all of this in-house under one roof.
That's
but definitely people that can speak to the intricacies of the accounting and the, you know, the legal aspects. Because when I go to a meeting on a tax credit project, if it's a larger, you know, it's not a residential property, there's half a dozen people at the table.
Yeah.
And I know things they don't know, they know things I don't know, and sometimes we never share any of that stuff because we don't need to, but we do help one another a lot, and it takes that kind of collaboration.
Yeah, the first meeting that we had as the team coming together was 8 people, you know, down at 56 Main Street. We walked through the building.
Excuse me, there are people in the audience who want to ask some questions. Yeah. Can we get back to the question and answer period?
Yeah, and we have to get home, too. We can't stay here forever.
I have a question.
Yes.
Do any of you have, in your knowledge base, any communities that have either accepted recently or rejected recently this process that you're talking about?
Well, Hillsdale just did one, and we were going to have someone from Hillsdale here to speak about their experience, but we didn't. And your question is a good one, because the next thing that I was going to say is that for one of your next meetings, you should have some people here who have been through this, and also not just a community leader, but perhaps somebody who had a private, you know, small commercial or a residential owner that has just done it, because I, you know, I'm talking about these 100,000 foot square mill projects,
but there are people who
you know, just own homes, and it's much simpler. You know, they're just working with a couple of people. So I'm making it look more complicated than it is.
Spencer Town rejected it?
No, Spencer Town.
Well, I wanted to hear both. You know, the ones who said yes and ones who said no. Anybody?
Not aware of any that have been rejected. I think that farm...
Not been rejected, farm, but rejected the process. You know.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I'm not aware of any. I think it's unusual. There's usually probably some kind of, you know, very vocal people who are not educated in what it is and what it isn't. And they're lawyers.
You touched on this, but I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more to give us just a sense of what kinds of things are eligible for the tax credits. And I'm going to talk about from the homeowner standpoint, because that's probably what most of us in here are concerned about, rather than income property.
Right.
Presumably, if I wanted to take the vinyl siding off of my house and put up wood siding, that would definitely qualify.
Yeah, and any of the brackets or details or trim that were knocked off when they put the siding on?
Yeah.
We find some old photographs, you know, replicate that stuff.
Okay. If I wanted to put a new bathroom on the first floor, it's an improvement, makes the house more usable, more saleable, would keep it from, you know, deteriorating over time.
Small floor plan changes like that are fine. I mean, if you have a house where part of its historical significance is the floor plan, it was either, you know, designed by some famous architect, or it's a certain kind of house, you know, like a salt box or whatever that has a certain kind of a floor plan. You can't alter that too much. They care a lot more about the outside of the house than the inside, to a degree.
No, I understand.
Can you add a bathroom downstairs? Yes.
Would I be eligible to get money to get a tax credit to do that improvement when it doesn't really affect the
well? Remember
of the house?
All of the systems that you're putting in the house, the utilities, your electrical, your plumbing, your HVAC, that's all eligible under the tax credit. So I don't think that a second bathroom is carved out by the accountant. And we're not paying for that. I don't think so.
Well,
by
maybe,
taking
but,
down the
okay,
screen,
what I'm clarifying is, it doesn't have to specifically improve the historical character of the house in order to be eligible for the credit.
Well, putting in central air.
Exactly.
Right. So those are the examples you give them where it's not improving the historical thing, which is
okay. That's a good thing to know.
Yes.
I have a general question. The way this map is, and I'm actually more asking this for my neighbor who neighbors across from you, whose house was built in 1974. So this wouldn't, you wouldn't need this. You wouldn't even do anything with this because, I mean, what is the you know, the marker of...
Well, that's a really, really good question. That's a great question.
I mean, my house is 103 years old, so I'm in this.
The National Register looks at things on a 50-year rolling cutoff date. So doing the math, you know, we're looking at houses in the 70s now. We're looking at ranch houses in the from the 70s now, right? So if it's outstanding, if it's done by a known architect, if it's in fantastic shape, or it's just a really, really great representative example of the split-level ranch houses that were built in this subdivision that was the first one in town, and because IBM built a plant there, I mean, it has a context. Yeah, I mean, this is the way we have to think about these things. I mean, you know, so are properties like that being surveyed and evaluated and determined eligible for the register? Yeah, I think the newest property that's included in the proposed National Register district is a church or a meeting hall here somewhere in town. 1969, is it? Yes. Yeah, so...
It's Tommy's.
So, you know, the answer is technically it has to be looked at, but it depends. Yes.
If I...
I'm going to get back to you. Yes.
Question from earlier. You know, everyone has all these questions, and it's great to hear about the different experts and the resources we're going to have. For me, the paperwork part is daunting.
Yeah.
And so I'm imagining that at some point we might have be able to do this as a group or as a, like have a workshop where maybe we could all like kind of do the paperwork together.
Yeah, well, the State Historic Preservation or office or some consultants can help you with that stuff. I know that looking from the outside looking in, that it does seem like a lot of paperwork, but that's what you hire these different people to do, is to shuffle it for you.
But I don't want to hire people. You know,
yeah.
I have a lot of
well,
money,
do it yourself. It's an adventure, and you can write a book about it.
I'm imagining that we would have like a workshop or something where we could do it. I just want to know that might be a resource that I could use. And then my other question is...
Lots of you know, homeowners,
yeah,
first-time tax credits, they tackle it themselves, and they do need a little bit of advice from this architect that they know or their lawyer or whatever. But they, you know, they can muddle through, and a lot of the guidance and questions that you have that you can't answer, you can get guidance from the state. People do it all the time.
I just want to know that resource, would exist.
You can always have a workshop.
And then workshop. And then my other question is, why is this going to take 18 months?
Well, backing up from the SHPO's review backlog, and then the fact that it has to be reviewed in Albany and then in Washington, so it goes into a lot of people's inbox and slowly rises, right? So, and then it takes a while to do. What I'm amazed at is how front-loaded this project is with the work that Jesse did, because that's a very comprehensive and detailed survey with a lot of context, individual properties, talks about all the different property types, I think some consultants and it's a smart strategy, is to front load the survey with a lot of stuff that, with little alteration and editing and rewriting, plugs into the different sections of the National Register nomination, the photographs, the maps, the different narratives. So that's a fantastic start. But the consultant, you know, also needs to put that in their queue, and it's a lot of writing and thinking. These things take time.
The other thing that's a reason why it's taking, will take 18 months, is that Jesse Ravish has to write the nomination.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that the group understands that nomination, that, you know, it takes the survey and writes the nomination. In of itself, that's going to take her 10 months to write it. And in the meantime, while she's writing it, our job is to increase the community consensus by doing workshops or, you know, addressing any questions that come up, so that by the time she's finished the nomination, the village of Philmont had held the public hearing, we got enough property owners who understand what it is. So that is going to take 18 months, 16 months, 18 months, if that helps. Explain that.
I don't think she'll be working on it every day, but these things take time. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yes, there is an issue with the new Climate Act legislation in New York State. The rulemaking is still in process, so we don't know where this is going to end up. But if there are programs or agencies that are an obstruction to climate change measures, they can be reviewed. So anything in a historic district, any construction going on in a historic district is exempt from the New York State Energy Code. So because of that, some municipalities in New York State are putting these proposals on in a moratorium until that gets resolved.
Mm.
So has your group, as a historian, have you been working on this, and how are you trying to get it resolved?
Haven't encountered it as a problem, but then again, I'm not doing a ton. I'm doing a handful of tax credit projects. They've been around a while. They may be grandfathered, but clients haven't asked me.
But climate change is a crisis for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm raising it as an issue.
Well, no, it's a good question, because you come up against issues of code at certain levels, state, county, local, and that conflict with the historic preservation guidelines and standards. And then there were other ones. Like, there was one that had to do with, was it HUD or something? It was something like that, where that had to do with reinstalling or removing, or how it was laid down, as a carpet. And like, you had to have it. So if they got this HUD money to rehab this mill, the tax credits and the SHPO and the preservation side of things said, well, you've got to expose the wooden floors and refinish them, and you can't sandblast them, and here's what you can and can't do, but this is the treatment for this element. And you can apply this construct to the posts and beams of the walls or whatever, you know. And then the HUD, I think it was HUD, said, well, you know, if we're using our money, all these buildings have to be carpeted inside. The carpet has to be glued down. It was a nightmare, you know. So somebody must have hashed it out. A lot of the times we found that the preservation wound up trumping these other things. Fire codes will trump the preservation. So again, sorry, but it's complicated.
Well, climate, as we progress,
yeah,
historic
preservation. Yeah,
and the credits are maybe better to do the climate measure rather than the historic.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And
so
hope,
that's the thing that has
hope,
to get away.
Hopefully people will come together, and hopefully the technical aspects of it will be integrated.
That
rather than throwing babies out with the bathwater, you know, yeah, you can put solar panels on the roof of the mill because it's flat and you can't see them. Let's move on, you
right.
know, and these things, you know,
you
can
be
work
able to put
together.
Them on your house in Philmont.
I'm sorry, what was the statement again?
You go through the program to get historic credits, and part of your construction project is to install solar panels.
Right.
Will you get covered for that in this program?
If they were approved because they were out of sight. Like, maybe they were on the back of the roof, but more likely like on a flat garage roof
right.
or something like that.
Yeah.
You couldn't see them. You run into this with mills all the time because there are so many roof penetrations for all of the vents, for instance. So if they bring them back so that you can't see them from certain angles and view sheds, that's part of the systems, the utilities. So preservation is becoming more and more solar panel friendly. And it just has to be done creatively.
Most
so,
of the houses in Philmont that have south-facing sloped roofs are visible.
Yeah.
So that's not, it sounds like it's not.
I think that would have to be reviewed on an individual basis.
Yeah. Okay.
But the legislation that you're talking about is certainly a big conflict, and sometimes conservation and preservation, don't work hand in hand.
Yeah, my only point is, hopefully, the historic preservation experts are helping to solve this problem.
Yeah.
As we move forward.
Okay. Well, I don't think that we can. You got to weigh what's important, and it's the air and the water
we're talking about being in the historic register, not a local historic.
Right. NRHD, not LHD. Yeah.
So therefore, people can have a historic house and not have to, and can get the energy efficiency code and replace their windows that way. And got those credits instead of having to go, or it's, otherwise you want to keep it historic.
You have to compare the credits from
right.
each program,
right.
which will be better off.
Right.
If,
so we're not as local, so we're not as restricted as that.
Right, but typically for a window,
that's what I just want to say. Yeah.
You don't want to have like one pane of glass.
No,
with the winter out there. Okay. So, but you have to have double hung wood sash. So they make windows now that are pretty sophisticated, certain kinds of cladding and double pane and triple pane glass, and you have wood on the outside, but just an applique on the grid applique on the inside, and the windows are their preservation windows are a whole industry, and so there are plenty of reviewed and accepted preservation window types that are this compromise between. Energy and preservation appearance.
So, could you double up on that?
No.
So, in that kind of case, could you get the exemption from the historic?
That's a question for the accountant.
Hi, can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
I really don't know what's going on, but I just have a question. Does everybody, once the community becomes historical, is everybody obligated to? The historical, or the National Historical Society, or whatever it's called, to be obligated to, does everybody have to be involved in this?
Well, what do you mean by involved?
Well, if somebody chooses not to be in the historic, have their house considered as historic.
Did you just come in?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay.
I was just asking.
So, I'll answer your question.
Thank you.
So, you got a national, proposed National Registered Historic District, and it's a 100 acres and 100 properties and 100 property owners. Okay? So 50% or more, they'll get a letter from the State Historic Preservation Office saying, we're proposing this historic district.
Yeah, but that's not the
right?
I'm just asking,
I don't know what you mean by involved, but people can approve or not approve.
Okay, but does
so, and they tally up the answers.
Okay.
So if more than 50% of the people say, I do not want, as a property owner, to have my property listed in the National Register of Historic Places, no district.
Okay.
If 50% or more than 50% of the people say, we do want this, then you get it.
The whole community has to be involved.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Yes? Yeah? Yeah, I think two things are going to happen. This has been recorded, and it's going to be available on, you can explain it better than I can. And then the PowerPoint is available, I made a PDF of it, which Sally already has.
Okay.
So if you, through whatever, mechanisms here in the community, you want to make both of those things available, they kind of go together.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, you condense down the historical stuff.
Thank you. Yes.
I just want to say to your question, you were saying we can actually
opt out.
Yes, absolutely. If we don't want the tax credits, and we don't get the tax credits, you don't do the preservation work, you don't get the tax credits.
That's voluntary. That's a voluntary on an individual basis.
That's what she's asking. Yeah.
Thank you.
So you can take advantage. Not everybody has to take advantage of the tax credits.
Okay.
But the buy-in is that 50%. But it doesn't impact you. Like you could tear your house down tomorrow if it was listed on the register.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yes. Hi. Getting back to the solar panels,
yes.
I worked on Block Island. I lived out there doing construction for 35 years on and off. And the town of New Shoreham is the government out there, basically. And they don't allow solar panels on roofs, but what a lot of people do is they put turnstiles out in their yard that are adjustable to the sun at different times of the year, and they're connected to deep cycle batteries, say golf cart batteries, in a rack in their basement with an alternative generator to charge those batteries. And it doesn't take away from the character of the salt boxes or anything. It's out in your yard, you can adjust it, it's total efficiency.
Right. And that's not attached to the house.
Right.
So that's moot.
Yeah.
As far as this is concerned. Yeah, there's probably a whole lot of things going on Block Island that you don't have or want here. Do you guys have any additional questions?
The question about the 18 months and the backlog and all, I think it seems that it's going to take a good chunk of time to keep educating people so that we have two people on a stream that know what they're, that have been informed of the difference, for example, the basic difference between the National Register and the local district, to answer people's questions. The questions that are coming up here will come up with other people. So I say, thank the Lord for the 18 months.
You'll need it.
There's a great,
it's a lot of education.
Solicitation and education.
Some stewardship.
That this meeting will, you know, so
one shot. Everybody has to understand when they're voting.
Sure, but between now and the 18 months, people need to be solicited that be those people that will outreach.
Well, I think a lot of the information on some of the slides on the PowerPoint, I tried to crystallize some of these issues and confusion. You know, we can always do this again.
So guys, step up. Join the college. There's a meeting every single month.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
Look over there.